Good afternoon, everyone. We've already heard a lot about the alliance, the United States, President Trump. Humphrey, you're a geographer. There is a saying attributed to Mark Twain that God created war so Americans could learn geography. It's worth remembering that. Let me begin with a fact, and resulting from that, the challenge confronting us. Fact is something that has been referred to already, not surprisingly, by several people. And that is that on 6th August 1945, Hiroshima was the target of the first use of the atomic bomb in war. Humphrey mentioned Nagasaki. The challenge is how we ensure that Nagasaki remains the last time ever that atomic or nuclear weaponry is used in warfare. The ambassador walked away from claiming success for the Ban Treaty. I will claim it as a success, for reasons that I shall outline in turn in a few moments. But initially, I want to emphasize why it was, in fact, a historic treaty, whether you call it merely an achievement or claim it as a success. It's historic for three broad sets of reasons. There are more nuances, but let me stick to three sets of reasons. It is, in fact, the first treaty to ban the bomb. No ifs, no buts, no temporary exemptions, no division of the world into haves and have-nots. It therefore completes the legal prohibition on the trilogy of weapons of mass destruction, following the Biological Weapons Convention from the 1970s and the Chemical Weapons Convention from the 1990s. It is historic, secondly, for an interesting reason. It is the first major humanitarian treaty in history to be adopted by the periphery in order to control the behavior of the central powers. Think about all the major treaties of international law, international humanitarian law, international human rights law. Not surprisingly, major powers tend to take the lead. And either they are universal and regulate everyone's behavior, or they exempt the major powers and regulate others' behavior. This is the first occasion on which the others, and not just from the global south, but including countries like Austria and New Zealand, our neighbors across the ditch, have done this. And third, related but just as importantly for someone who's an ex-United Nations official, this is the first time in which the United Nations General Assembly asserted itself on a major issue, and that too dealing with national security, against the combined united opposition of the five permanent members to adopt a treaty. And I think that is significant because it alludes to a little remarked storyline in the trajectory of human history. And that is the gradual displacement of purely power relations governing world affairs, and the gradual creeping in of normative elements. Because in the UN system, the Security Council, dominated by the five permanent members, is the geopolitical center of gravity. But the normative center of gravity is the General Assembly. And the unique legitimacy of the United Nations comes not from the geopolitical cockpit, but from the universal membership of the General Assembly. When we say the international community, only the United Nations General Assembly can represent the international community. So it's historic in that sense as well. But let me go back. What is the problem? We've heard mentions of Reagan's statement and others, and we've heard Obama's Prague speech. He also visited Hiroshima. And while there, he said, and I quote, "On a bright, cloudless morning, death fell from the sky, and the world was changed. A flash of light and a wall of fire destroyed a city and demonstrated that mankind possessed the means to destroy itself," unquote. That picks up very nicely on another now forgotten quote from President Kennedy in his State of the Union speech in January 1962, when he used the metaphor that nuclear weapons seem to offer us present security but threaten the future survival of the human race. "The bomb," he said, "has turned the world into a prison in which humanity awaits its execution." That was then. Now we deal with Trump. The normative anchor of the global nuclear order is, remains, and I join the ambassador, a vitally important, critically important treaty, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968. Article 6 of that, I quote exactly verbatim, "Each of the parties to the treaty undertakes to pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date and to nuclear disarmament," unquote. That's the wording of the NPT. The United States is a state party. The United States and the then Soviet Union negotiated that treaty. This year, the Nuclear Posture Review of the United States has only one brief paragraph referencing last year's Ban Treaty. And it says, and I quote, "The Ban Treaty seeks to inject disarmament issues into non-proliferation fora, potentially damaging the non-proliferation regime." In other words, they're completely denying the existence of Article 6, let alone its relevance to guiding their nuclear posture. That is a reality we face today. Humphrey mentioned the New Zealand connection. Well, I lived in New Zealand for 15, 16 years through the great 1980s there. Let me update a campaign poster from that movement, which at that time featured in a cinema-style poster Ronald Reagan, because, of course, he was a former actor, and Margaret Thatcher. An update to what is happening today, even this week, the extent to which we blindly align ourselves with some of the, shall we say, crazier U.S. policies. And that is, our government promises to follow President Trump to the end of the world, and he in turn promises faithfully to do his very best to bring it about. Why do we need the Ban Treaty? Previous speakers have done it. Firstly, of course, because of the non-implementation of Article 6 and the rising anger and exasperation at the failure to do so. Secondly, because of the totally stalled nuclear arms control talks, regimes falling by the wayside, INF crumbling, as Stefan said, ABM abandoned a long time ago, Americans resisting Russian overtures to extend the New START treaty by 5 years. It's a collapse of the fraying of the arms control regime, the end of arms control history, Alexei Arbatov of Russia said. Meantime, growing consciousness of elevated nuclear risks and threats, including as a result of the spike in geopolitical tensions in Central Europe, in the Balkans, in the Middle East, in the subcontinent, a tense military standoff even between India and China on the border last year, and of course in the Pacific as well. I think greater awareness that ultimately deterrence rests on a number of myths, a belief in magical realism. It is not supported historically. We know of no single case where a country with the bomb was engaged in an effort at nuclear blackmail and succeeded. Nor do we know of any case where a country was poised to attack another country, but was deterred by the existence of nuclear weapons on the other side. We've had plenty of accidents and near misses. The world has been saved from nuclear war as a result of deliberate disobedience by the officers concerned of orders to launch nuclear weapons, because they were not convinced that the orders were genuine, even though they had been authenticated. And in one case, it was genuine, but wasn't prepared to take the risk. And these have happened with a 30-minute flight time for missiles in the central dynamic between Washington and Moscow. That 30-minute reduces to 4 minutes when you're dealing with India and Pakistan. And yet even that exchange would be sufficient to destroy us all. So there's all those things. But of course, the opposite you can say as well. Just accept for the moment that, yes, deterrence is wonderful. It's the best invention by mankind ever for preserving nuclear peace and general peace. That being the case, why do we not encourage proliferation? Why don't we lend our technical expertise and our massive reserves of uranium to Iran and to North Korea? If we really believe deterrence works, well, the answer is obvious. We know it doesn't. We know it's high risk. We know it multiplies the risks. And there is that fundamental contradiction which comes up even in the denial by the Americans, as in the Nuclear Posture Review, and not just the Americans, but all the nuclear weapon states, that there is this legal obligation in the NPT. On the one hand, they will insist there is no legal obligation. On the other hand, they say, we don't need another treaty that embeds a legal prohibition. Well, you can't have it both ways. If there is the gap, that is what has been filled. And that is what the treaty does. What the humanitarian movement did that the ambassador referred to was update the Canberra Commission conclusions, which were still framed within the security paradigm. As long as any country has nuclear weapons, others will want them. As long as they exist, they will be used again someday. If not by design, then by mistake, accident, rogue launch, system error. Any use of nuclear weapons could be catastrophic for the whole world, entirely within the security paradigm. That is now updated by the humanitarian consequences movement, and the ICRC and the National Red Crosses, including Australia in particular, have been major contributors to that and champions of that, is no country individually, nor the international system collectively, has the capacity to cope with the humanitarian consequences of any use of nuclear weapons. Secondly, it is in the interest of the very survival of humanity, therefore, that nuclear weapons are never used again under any circumstances. And third, only complete abolition can guarantee permanent non-use of nuclear weapons. And that's what the treaty does. And the reason it is a success is there are different components of the nuclear disarmament agenda. I break them down into five. The Ban Treaty addresses the first two: stigmatize and delegitimize through a legal prohibition. It will come into force when 50 states have ratified. As of very recently, maybe still the case, 60 had signed, 19 had ratified. The normative force, I think, will really kick in once you have 100 states that have ratified. That becomes very powerful then and much more difficult to ignore. What are the remaining three things that still have to be done, which can only be done by those who have the bomb? Cap additional production of materials, fissile materials, and bombs. Asia, by the way, is the only continent where nuclear bombs are actually increasing, and they're increasing in all countries that have them in Asia. But cap also the, as I said, fissile material production, which is a major issue in some countries, and we don't have the FMCT in place yet. Stop the testing, also cap that. the North Koreans can cap whatever they've got to begin with, then move to reducing numbers, role of doctrines, role change your postures, reduce reliance on launch on alert systems. There are about 2,000 weapons on high alert. Reduce various other things. And finally, eliminate through a nuclear weapons convention that is universal, that is verifiable, that will take time because it is a technically complex and legally complex issue. And the actual dismantlement will also take time. The Chemical Weapons Convention has been in operation for a long time. We still haven't completed that agenda. So it's not going to be an overnight success. But it sure won't happen without the normative pressure from the rest of the world on those who have the weapon. And that is why this is a success. And had it been all that inconsequential, we wouldn't have had that enormous pressure on allies not to give in, not to sign. And let me close with the statement that if you go back to Article 6 of the NPT, of which we are a state party, it says each of the parties to the treaty. It doesn't just say those with the bomb. We are all legally obligated to pursue disarmament. With the best will in the world, I cannot for the life of me see how our non-participation in the conference was compatible with this Article 6 obligation. I'm not saying we should have signed. That's a different issue. But not even taking part in a UN-mandated multilateral conference when no other negotiations were underway, when the last NPT review conference was a failure, I find it very difficult to see that that was in compliance with our obligation under the NPT. And finally, back to my New Zealand days, if you still believe in nuclear deterrence, let me remind you of the man who jumps from the 40th floor, and as he passes the 30th floor, he's heard to say, "So far, so good." Thank you.